For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Cool. I'm Mike Sullivan. I'm on staff here. I've been working here since 1998, which is a long time. I teach our adult ed classes. I teach one of our weekend central teachings, and I oversee a cluster of home churches, adult home churches that we call a sphere. So why don't we turn to God? I'm super pumped to do this topic. I think it's really interesting. Hopefully it'll be helpful for you guys. All right, Father, I just pray this would be a productive time. I pray you would give us just a renewed depth of conviction that when you write about these miracle accounts, they've actually happened. And when you say that we have access to your power, it's actually there, that this isn't some kind of fairy tale here, but you're the living God. You're in each of our hearts. And as we go into the world to represent your interests, you're with us. And we have access to limitless power. I just pray that you deepen our conviction that that's the case. Amen. What we're going to get into is miracles. I think if you read the Bible, you can't miss, when you read the Gospels in particular, how frequent miracles are. And they're pretty amazing miracles. I'll just give you a list of some of the more famous miracles that Jesus did. And what strikes me as I look at all of these different miracles is, you know, I'm 54. I've never seen anything like this happen in my entire life. I've never seen someone walk on water. I've never seen someone go fishing and catch a coin that I knew was there in a fish's mouth. The, you know, an instant healing where something's cut off and then instantly restored, like the ear of the high priest's servant. You know, we read a lot of these things and people are skeptical because when's the last time you saw anything like this happen? Not just in the world out there, but in the church also. And so we just want to think through, what about this? Did any of this stuff really happen? And it's not a small question. There's really a lot at stake when you think about this question of miracles having occurred or not occurred. There really is a lot at stake. If you read the Gospel of John, after he lays out all of these miracles, which he calls signs, he summarizes his account and he says, these signs, these miracles have been written so that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you might have life in his name. So think about his reasoning. I've laid these miracles out to persuade you to believe. Flip that on its head. If they're not true, then everything we believe about Jesus is called into question. So it really matters that these things actually occurred. If not, I don't know why we should trust anything that's in here. And so before we get in specifically to talk about Jesus and his miracles, let's just think about miracles in general. We're going to just talk about whether or not there's any evidence for them. Then we'll get more specifically into Jesus' miracles. We'll look at what his miracles mean. Like, what was the whole point of him doing these miracles? I'm going to raise a question that always comes up in connection with Christians and miracles. And then I want to talk about evangelism and how it's impacted by the miraculous. Okay, that's really what I want to get to. I want to get to that last part. Now, is there any evidence? Well, first let's define what it is. You got to start your talk by defining your terms, right? A miracle, what is that? That's when you go into the BMV and it only takes 10 minutes. That's miraculous. That's never happened to me before. I've been there many times. How about this? When the Cleveland Browns win a playoff game. That would be a total miracle. If you look, the dictionaries, the standard definition's pretty good. It's not an exotic concept. It's an extraordinary event manifesting divine intervention in human affairs. It's something where we see this happen and we recognize that's the hand of God. God is the one that actually made this event possible. That's what we're looking at with the miracle, something where there's no other plausible explanation, where it's something that is credibly tied to something that God would do. That's what a miracle looks like. When you look at all the miracles in the gospel, that's probably the most fitting description. Now, I could show you, obviously, hundreds of quotes from skeptics who don't believe in miracles. They're not hard to find. Here's one guy. This guy's a staff writer for the New Yorker. His name is Adam Gopnik. Just listen to what he says here. It's pretty awe-inspiring, the claim he makes. He says, "We know that in the billions of years that the universe has existed, there is no evidence of a single miraculous intercession with the laws of nature." So you'd have to be pretty vigilant for quite a long time and be in quite a few places to be able to say authoritatively, you know, "I've looked under every rock and in every nook and cranny of the universe, and I can confirm that this has never happened." Yeah, it would take a miracle to know that. So you just realize a lot of these guys, they're speaking with almost omniscient, you know, type of knowledge. Is this claim based on something like careful observation? That's absurd. No, what is this based on? It's based on the presupposition that miracles are absolutely impossible. That's what it's undeniable. It's based on starting out with the assumption that these kinds of things never occur, that the only kind of things that do occur are governed by the natural laws that we observe. And so thinking about that, I guess it raises the natural question, are there any documented examples? Have we, in the billions of years that the earth has existed, ever observed something that we would say, "Yeah, I think that was a bona fide miracle"? If you're interested in this topic, probably the most popular book on this, and I mean that by easy to read book, would be Lee Strobel's book, The Case for Miracles. Now, I'm going to read you one of the, again, I could cite several interesting examples of well-documented events that I think merit the status of miracle. But I'm just going to read one to you. It's not just something he's documented. I remember in 1983, I read about this in Christianity Today, this particular miracle. It was very well documented. The two doctors involved in this woman's case, Barbara Comiskey Snyder, wrote a book about it. There are many multiple eyewitnesses. It was a dramatic healing. And I'm going to give you the blow-by-blow account. And I've looked into this. This is a well-documented example of something that is very difficult to explain apart from the miraculous. Okay, so Barbara Comiskey Snyder was a teenager diagnosed at the Mayo Clinic with progressive multiple sclerosis. She was cared for at Central DuPage Hospital in Winfield, Illinois. One of her doctors, Dr. Harold Adolph, a board-certified surgeon, said, "Barbara was one of the most hopelessly ill patients I ever saw." Barbara had been had been super healthy as a kid. She was really athletic. But at age 15, she began to trip, bump into walls, and lose strength in her grip. When her condition worsened, she was diagnosed with progressive multiple sclerosis. That's really got a bad prognosis, especially in the early 80s. And as predicted, over the next 16 years, Barbara's condition worsened. One of her lungs wasn't functional at all. The other was below 50%. There were a variety of complications and interventions, like a breathing tube, loss of bowel control, and ileostomy, you know, the bag for your waist that they connect, losing most of her eyesight, a feeding tube, all this stuff. By 1981, she was confined to bed in hospice in her home. She hadn't walked in 7 years. Her body was curled up like a pretzel. Her arms were retracted like this just because they had gone so long without being used. And she was suffering. It was really bad. So a local radio station got people to pray for her, and listeners wrote in prayer cards. And then her aunt and two of her aunt's friends went to Barbara's bedroom. They read these prayer cards out loud to Barbara. And while that was happening, Barbara says she heard a voice behind her, a loud, authoritative voice that said, "My child, get up and walk." Her aunt then noticed that, you know, Barbara seemed agitated. So she walked over to Barbara, put her thumb on the hole in where her breathing tube was so she could speak. And Barbara croaked out, "Go get my family." Her family shows up into the bedroom, and Barbara got up out of bed and stood on legs she hadn't stood on in 7 years. And she danced around the room with her dad. And she went to church that night, showed up at the congregation, and people were just like, you know, people had visited her. They were completely flipped out. And then the next day, she walked down the hospital to go see her doctors. And this is a quote from the doctor. He said, "I saw her walking toward me, and I thought I was seeing an apparition." And she's been alive for 35 years since, and she's totally healthy. This isn't like my back pain got better. When her mom saw her, her mom's first reaction was, "Barbara, you have calves." In other words, you had no muscle tone. Now you instantly do. Wow. So this is very well documented. Go look at it yourself, or come up to me, or email me. I'll send you notes on it. This is the real deal. Here she is. You can actually go look her up on Facebook. Barbara Comiskey Snyder. She's a Bears fan. So there you go. Her husband's a pastor. Another excellent book I would recommend, I don't have too much time to get into a lot of this, but this is Tom Doyle. He's a Dallas Seminary grad. If you know anything about Dallas Seminary, they're not real big on signs and wonders and miracles, but he's done a lot of research about what's happening in the Muslim world. And in this book, he has some very well-documented stories of Muslims who have dreams about Jesus, and in these dreams, Jesus says, "Hey, look for this person." And they see the person in the dream, and Jesus says, "Go to them, and they will tell you more about me." And so the person wakes up that morning, and they're walking around, and they'll see someone who looks just like the person Jesus indicated in their dream. They go up to that person. Turns out of thousands of people who don't believe in Christ, this particular person's a church planter or some other, maybe a hidden believer, and they wind up becoming a Christian. You've probably already heard stories like this coming from the Muslim world, but they are very well documented, and if you want more background on that, check out that book. So my whole point, I don't want to spend too much time on this. To Gopnik or to David Hume or Spinoza, all the different critics of miracles, I think we could make a strong case that credible miracle reports do exist, that there actually are credible miracle reports. Now, somebody that was an atheist or rationalist or naturalist hearing me say this, they'd be like, "Oh, come on. Of course everybody in the room believes here. You're all a bunch of believers. You're already predisposed. You are credulous, which means you're inclined to believe. You're already ready to buy anything that you're told." And I think that's a really unfair caricature of you guys or any large group of Christians. Christians I know are pretty thoughtful. They don't just believe everything that they're told. If I told you, if I walked in here right now and I said, my neighbor died next door and I rose him from the dead, I don't think you would just buy that, right? I don't think Christians are just flat out credulous. I think we're more thoughtful. If you actually were to read some of the kind of the better written meditations on miracles in the evangelical world, if you read, for instance, Craig Keener, who does believe in miracles, but if you read his book, he's really clear. He says here, we should look at the evidence with a healthy dose of skepticism, but also with an open mind. He's like, we should absolutely scrutinize what we're hearing. There's nothing spiritual at all about just blindly choking down somebody's miracle claim. That's absurd. Nobody says that's spiritual. In fact, the Bible warns against that quite a bit. If you read several places. Here's an example. This is describing the end of history when there's this guy, the man of lawlessness, the Antichrist. It says that period of history is going to be is going to be characterized by lots of deception connected to miraculous activity. Okay, so you've got 2 Thessalonians 2:9. This man will come to do the work of Satan with counterfeit power and signs and miracles. He'll use every kind of evil deception to fool those on their way to destruction. So the notion that we live in a world populated by ancient demons who are brilliant, who could possibly fool people with pseudo-miracles, something that we can maybe even test and measure and be like, I don't know how this happened. We got to be really careful. This area, to just blindly believe something is a miracle or to blindly accept a message connected with the miracle, the Bible does not want you to be credulous. The Bible wants you to be skeptical and careful about this area. There have been and always will be false prophets who mislead folks. Okay, and so I think this is kind of a famous atheist maxim, but I think Christians should follow it. Extraordinary claims, like I raised my neighbor from the dead, that requires extraordinary proof. There better be some documentation or something before you expect me to believe that. And not just that, we can't just stop at asking, did this happen? That's not enough for a Christian. We have to also ask, is the message connected with this event consistent with Scripture? Because if it isn't, I don't care how miraculous it looks, it must be rejected. So you guys with me on this so far? Okay. Good. So what would we say to the world of miracle deniers out there? There are lots of people who presuppose they can't occur. This is G.K. Chesterton. I love this picture. It's like somebody punched him in the face and he's just barely standing up. Yeah, he's in a daze. This guy is brilliant. I mean, super smart guy. He's talking to the rationalist, to the atheist. He says, you affirm the main principle of materialism, the abstract impossibility of a miracle. You have a perfect right to do so, but in that case, you're the dogmatist. It's we Christians who accept all actual evidence. It's you rationalists who refuse actual evidence, being constrained to do so by your creed. That's the rap that's laid on Christians. You believe in the creed that Jesus is real. You must accept miracles. False. We do believe Jesus is real, but we don't choke down every miracle claim. And yet these guys do have a creed. Their creed is all miracles are false, and it blinds their ability to objectively look at this area. He's exactly right about that. And I'm curious, some of you guys are from our church, some aren't. I'm just curious to hear what you guys think. So you're in your church, and you got somebody who's making this amazing claim that they did a miracle. And it's an amazing miracle, and people are getting real excited about this story. And you're sitting there like, I don't know. What kind of criteria should we use to evaluate a miracle claim? It's a lot like, when you think about this, a miracle is a historical event in the sense if it really happened, it happened in time and space and history, and it happened in the past. And so we can't get 100% proof. There's no way. We have to evaluate this the same way we would try to determine if Caesar really crossed the Rubicon or if some other event actually occurred. We'd have to go in there and interview people and try to get eyewitnesses and so on. Don't feel bad about the fact that we can't have 100% proof. We do all kinds of important things without 100% proof, like get on a flight to Europe without knowing for sure it's going to get there, like sending somebody to prison for life. Why? Because it's 100% proven? No, because it's beyond a reasonable doubt. And so it's okay. It's okay that to be like, yes, I can marshal enough evidence to make the credible claim that a miracle has occurred, but I need to be careful about that. I got to do the work and really verify it. Now, Jesus miracles. When I was a kid in grade school, somebody told me George Washington, from his home in Mount Vernon, threw a silver dollar across the Potomac. And I believed it. Hook, line, and sinker, I totally believed it. But if you go there, it's like a half mile wide. There's no way he did that. And it turns out there actually is a historical core to the story. It wasn't a silver dollar, it was a rock. And it wasn't the Potomac, it was some other river. But see, what happened is, over time, the story was told and retold over 100, 200 years, and pretty soon it's this legend that he did this superhuman feat, but it's not true. And what about this? I mean, is maybe that's what happened with Jesus the miracle worker, right? Maybe he did some helpful things when he was alive, some hard things to explain, but it just kind of mushroomed into, holy cow, that guy is a miracle worker. And that we've got this legend now about everything that he did. So what about that? One thing I would say that makes these miracle claims in the Gospels unique is they're very different than the claims of other first century miracle workers. There are actually other people that were running around in the first 100 years after the birth of Christ who were regarded as miracle workers. They're written up in ancient literature. One of the most famous ones, and I could give you, again, examples of this, but one will have to suffice, Apollonius of Tyana. He did a lot of miracles, was regarded as a miracle worker. One of the cool ones I can tell you about is the stoning of the demon beggar. So there was this guy that came into town. He was a beggar. And when he showed up in town, the whole city was struck with a plague. And so Apollonius did a civic duty and had a mob of people stone this poor beggar to death. Okay? So in the story, the beggar is dead under a pile of stones. And people come over and they start pulling off the stones. And underneath, it turns out it's not the beggar. It's a demon dog foaming at the mouth. He's totally like mutated into this dog. And there's a lot of other kind of super fantastic elements to the story. And that's what you see with a lot of these stories, is just like lots of bells and whistles, lots of flourishes and fantastic accounts. And then you read a miracle in the Gospels. Jesus goes into the synagogue in Capernaum. He sees a guy possessed by an evil spirit, and this is how Jesus did his miracle. It says he reprimanded the guy, said, "Shut up and come out." And that's it. There's no flourish, no amazing extra stuff. He's just like, "You, be quiet and leave." Very spare. Very much unlike first century miracle workers' accounts. Nothing like them at all. So yeah, this account and many of the miracle accounts of Jesus just completely lacks all the bells and whistles associated with legends. Here's something else. And you see this all over the New Testament. Remember the story where Jesus heals the man born blind? The guy's been blind since birth. Jesus restores his sight, or gives him sight for the first time, actually. And it was an amazing miracle. And everybody knew it. Everybody knew this guy had been blind for a long time. And it leads to this really, like, a whole chapter long debate with the Pharisees about how they're spiritually blind hypocrites. And then at the end of the whole thing, Jesus says, for judgment I've come into this world so that the blind will see, and so that those who see will be blind. And so what's unique about this, what's not just, it's different than these other miracle workers, is not only does he do this miracle, but it is directly integrated with what he's trying to teach. In other words, the nature of the act itself illustrates, it's like a moving analogy to help people understand the spiritual truth that he's teaching. You see what I'm saying? That puts Jesus' miracles in a completely different category. There really isn't anything like that happening in the lives of these other miracle workers. Here's another thing that obviously we would want to know. With a lot of miracles, they happen kind of like in a galaxy far, far away. If you read like some of the Indian holy books, there are crazy miracles happening, but it's hard to locate where and what time, who is alive at this time. Jesus' miracles are really different. They actually happened in towns you can visit, in cultures we understand, in a period of history we know about. And because of that, Jesus' miracles are filled with innocuous details that can be verified or that could actually falsify the whole account. No, there's just little mentions of, you know, different things happening in the scene where the miracle occurs. If those things are wrong, then it calls the whole miracle into question. But if they're right, it just gives this miracle more weight and credibility. And it turns out, if you look at a lot of Jesus' miracles, the little details, they add credibility to the whole account. For instance, what we just read in Mark 1, there was a healing in a synagogue in Capernaum. We've dug up the first century synagogue that actually was in Capernaum during this time. You can go visit the ruins of this synagogue. Another one would be the funeral in Galilee. If you read in Luke 7, it's this funeral in a town called Nain, which is up in Galilee, and there's a grieving widow leading the casket, and she's in front of the funeral procession, in front of the casket. And it turns out that in Galilee, in the first century, that's the way they did it. If you were to go to southern Israel, like down into Judah, down into, you know, around Jerusalem, that was not their practice. So that little detail. What about the feeding of the 5,000? If you compare the different gospel accounts of that event, and you kind of compare, it's written out four different times. It happened in the spring. And then in John it says that they actually sat down, or no, it was in Mark. It says they sat down on green grass. That's an important detail because it's only in spring that the grass is green. The rest of the time, it's brown. So you see what I mean? Just these little details, things you wouldn't even think about when you dive in and go, well, what about that? It fits. It fits the reality that we all live in, and that helps. And thirdly, we've got sources outside the Bible that actually attest that Jesus performed miracles. A lot of people don't know this, but it's true. You should get a book called Jesus Outside the New Testament by Van Voorst. Jesus Outside the New Testament. He documents a lot of these. But you take something, for instance, like, well, what did Jewish tradition after the time of Christ say about Jesus? They never deny that he did miracles. They attributed his miracle working to sorcery. You can read about it yourself. There was a critic, an early critic of Christianity named Celsus. And Celsus doesn't deny that Jesus did miracles. He says that Jesus went to Egypt to learn the dark arts. You can also read Josephus, who was not a believer, not a friend of Christians. And in a passage that's not disputed, this is an authentic part of what Josephus wrote, he describes Jesus as a worker of surprising works. And so what you get when you get the oldest witnesses outside the Bible that we have about Jesus, you get this. They're agreeing that Jesus was doing something extraordinary. What they disagree on is the cause. That is true. And so because of these things I'm laying out, to just take these miracles and sweep them into the dustbin of legend, no way. You cannot do that with Jesus' miracles. They're way more compelling than that. This is why the miracle working of Jesus in the Gospels is like nothing else we have in any type of literature. It does teach something, but that's not all that it does. It, like we said, addresses physical needs. You know, if you read the account of the feeding of the 5,000, look what he says. I feel compassion for the people that are out here listening to me because they've been with me 3 days and they have nothing to eat. So this miracle, it's not just a demonstration of God's power. It just reveals the nature of his character. He cares about people. They show there's this relationship Jesus has, where he doesn't just do what he wants, but he looks to the Father. And when the Father gives him the power to do something, he does it, right? So Jesus, right before he raises Lazarus from the dead, he says, Father, I thank you that you've heard my prayer. Or you think about what Alex said here. How do we know that he's really the Messiah? I'm not going to read all this, but if you read these Old Testament passages, It tells us in the Old Testament to look for certain miracles and signs to verify that somebody is the Messiah. And Jesus does those specific miracles. That's part of what we're seeing in the Gospels. He's not just doing anything. He's doing the kinds of things the Old Testament said the Messiah would do. Okay, and that, so there's that. And real quick, too, the idea of just the compassion. You know, there was a scene with a leper, and leprosy was horrific to look at. People avoided lepers. Some lepers might go decades without feeling the touch of another human. And when Jesus saw this leper at the end of Mark 1, it says he was moved to compassion, and he reached out and touched him and healed him. Okay, so there's so much more happening with miracles than just teaching us some lesson. That's part of it, but it's more than that. All right, let's hear you guys from this, about this. So you go to church. You go to church 2-3 times a week, some of you. You never see or rarely see the kind of miracles that we're reading about in the Bible. So what about it? If signs and wonders are so prevalent in the Gospels and Acts, why aren't they a normal part of the church today? There's no doubt, and I hope you guys aren't hearing me say, that this has stopped. 1 Corinthians 12 talks about people having the gift of miracles, gift of healings. And so the idea that this never happens, that's not true. We do, even today, and not just like over in Papua New Guinea, but right here in Columbus. Over the 40-year history of our church, we've seen a few things that I would put in the miracle category for sure. So here's a couple thoughts for you. We do see miracles. We can affirm that. We can find some well-documented examples of that. But isn't it undeniable that we're not seeing them with the same frequency and intensity that we see in the New Testament? I think that's pretty undeniable. A couple things to keep in mind. Jesus is kind of unique, right? He's special. He's the Messiah. The apostles, they're the guys that gave us the New Testament. They gave us God's revelation in the books of the New Testament. If you look at these verses, think about what they imply. Okay, so in Acts it says that Jesus was attested to us by God with miracles and wonders and signs. Okay, and then over here it says that Paul, he's describing his ministry among the Corinthians. He says, the signs, the miracle working of a true apostle were performed among you. What is he saying? He's saying there was something distinctive about the miracle working I did that helped you go, oh, that guy, he's an apostle. Same thing here. There was something distinctive and unusual about what was happening with Jesus that helped people realize that guy's the Messiah. And so just think about the implication. This means that the miracle working we see during their ministries in the Gospels, in Acts, they have to be a departure from the norm. Does that make sense? I mean, just, we should not expect the same level of miraculous activity in their lives, in our lives, that we see in theirs, because they're special. Here's something else, too. Think about the uniqueness of the times. You know, the Gospels and Acts are they record two titanic events in God's plan of salvation: the arrival of the Messiah and the birth of the new covenant. Those two events, according to the Old Testament, those two events will be preceded by miracles and signs. And so again, these were special periods of history where unique things were happening to help people recognize who God's authorities were. And then there's just, think about this too. If you take all of the Gospels and you read the entire book of Acts, that's almost 40 years. Almost 40 years of what happened. And so if you had lived back then, would it have been a miracle a day? No, these books are giving us the highlights, key miracles that helped advance God's plan in history, key miracles that helped illustrate truths about who Jesus was. What we're reading in these books is something more like, you know, the sports highlights in the local news. You don't watch the whole football game. When you watch the local news, they give you the 4 or 5 really key plays that made, you know, the outcome happen or whatever. So, see what I'm saying? These are like This is like highlight footage. And so to take all that and say it should be a miracle a day in our experience, it just doesn't make sense. So I would conclude here, no, we shouldn't expect to see miracles with the same frequency and intensity as we do in the New Testament. Do they happen? Yes, absolutely. But we shouldn't expect them to be just like the same frequency and intensity in the Bible. Now, let me ask you guys, I'm curious. I want to shift over to talking about evangelism a little bit. I'm curious if anybody here would say that part of why you're a Christian is because you witnessed a miracle or had some kind of encounter with God, you know, something supernatural happened to you that led you to believe in Christ. And, you know, just somebody here has a story like that, I'd be really curious to hear. I just think you'd be surprised if you start to talk to people. There, a lot of people would say, you know, I did have some kind of encounter with the living God. Sometimes it's an extreme story. Sometimes it's I just walked into a room of people that were totally different and I saw love there that I've never seen before. There's a spectrum. But it's undeniable that if you look over the history of the church, miracles have led people to Christ. I think about Philip. Philip was performing these different miracles. And it says, crowds listened intently to him because they were eager to hear his message and see the miraculous signs. And it goes on to talk about how many people believed and how it was related partly to the signs that they saw. Look at what Paul says here in Romans 15. This is a very sweeping statement. He says, from Jerusalem to Illyricum, which is a widespread, he's mentioning all the different places that he's visited, all the different Gentile areas. He says these people were convinced by the power of miraculous signs and wonders and by the power of God's Spirit. And so he's saying, in this way, I've fully presented the good news. It's pretty clear that during this time, the early church and during the time of Christ, God was powerfully using miracles to try to validate the message that people were hearing. So a lot of folks go, and we have critics. Folks look at Xenos and other churches like ours where we don't feature miracles, and they're like, why aren't you, you know, featuring this method of miracle working to bring people into a relationship with God? It's called power evangelism. And here's a couple reasons why. One is, and this is again, it's not the highlights. This is kind of what was it like day to day? How did Paul operate? It says, as was Paul's custom, he went to the synagogue service and for three Sabbaths he used the scriptures to reason with the people. He explained the prophecies, proved that the Messiah must suffer and rise from the dead, and he said, hey, this Jesus, he's the Messiah. That's typically how it went. When you describe what it was like, you know, how they perceived what is evangelism. Look what Paul says here. God's given us this task of reconciling people to him. That's evangelism. And what does he call it? He says, well, we're Christ's ambassadors. God's making his appeal through us. We speak for Christ when we plead, come back to God. So the essence of evangelism is proclaiming a message of forgiveness through Christ. That doesn't mean it can't be enhanced by miracles. It can. But we got to remember the time and the setting, the people that were doing those miracles, absolutely. And we got to remember a couple other things too. If we should be featuring miracle working in our evangelism, why doesn't the New Testament ever once command us to do that? That's just really weird that nowhere in the New Testament are we commanded as a body of believers to get out and do miracle working in our community. It's just not there. This a command, you go out and perform signs and wonders. It's not there. The other thing is that what we do see God urging Christians to do in the New Testament is to proclaim, verbally proclaim the gospel. And so I would say, no, we don't want to feature miracle working in our witnessing. But here is a potential tragedy for a church like us. And the tragedy would be if we reduced witnessing to just a conversation between me and somebody else. that it's just mano a mano. I'm going to lay it out and hopefully they'll be persuaded. That's not what happens when we share our faith. And let's think about this a little bit. When we're sharing our faith, we should be confident that God is present and powerfully at work. He's drawing people, kind of like you described, almost feeling like you're in a tractor beam, being pursued by God. I remember feeling that way. He's connecting us with receptive people. I mean, we're, you know, like we saw in Acts 8, like maybe you've experienced, God plops a very receptive person right across your path who is in a life situation where they're ready to hear the gospel. I believe in divine appointments. Paul says, pray for open doors. So there's that. That's God at work. God giving us the words to speak. God convicting the people we're talking to of the sin that they're culpable of the fact that they will face judgment, that there is a God. God sits on people like a 600-pound gorilla and convicts them when they hear the gospel. So yeah, totally. God is very present there. And I also would throw out, you know, there's just something about the potency of the message. I remember sitting in Central Teachings when I first was coming out to our church and just feeling like somebody cracked open my sternum and was inserting truth into my heart. I just remember like, why is this resonating so deeply? I don't know if you can remember that, but I remember the Bible itself was just like, wow. So these are all evidences. And in addition to these, which should give us not a cocky swagger, but this assurance that we're not doing this alone. In addition to this, we should be praying that God, in a palpable way, in a way that's appropriate for the person we're talking to, we should pray that he would make himself known. Make himself known in all the different ways that you guys are describing. And this is a legit prayer because God's the living God. He's present and he is able to help people sense his presence. I was reading an article in the New Yorker, and this is written by an atheist about how hard it is to be an atheist. Just what it's like to live in a world where there's no God. He says, I've got a friend, an analytic philosopher, a convinced atheist who told me that she sometimes wakes up in the middle of the night anxiously turning over a series of ultimate questions. How can it be that this world is the result of an accidental Big Bang? How could there be no design, no metaphysical purpose? Can it be that every life, beginning with my own, my husband's, my child's, and spreading outward, is cosmically irrelevant? And what's so great about this article is it's just admitting we do have a God-shaped void. We do feel the absence of God. We can assume that God wants to fill this vacuum with himself, with the reality of who he is. Just one last story I'll tell you, then we can maybe take some questions. I had a buddy who had gone through a terrible divorce. I was best friends with him in high school. And I was hanging out with him. We were driving around in his Mazda Miata. And we pulled into my driveway after hanging out most of the night. And he was just completely heartbroken. Just, you know, his whole life was coming apart because his marriage was ending. And I remember sitting in the passenger seat like, I don't know what to tell this guy. And I just got the thought, well, hey, I was like, I turned to my friend. I was like, look, I just feel so terrible for everything you've had to go through. I don't have words to speak, but would you mind if I just quickly turned to God and prayed? And I, just on a whim, I don't usually operate that way. So I did, and I just prayed for him. I was like, Lord, I can't imagine what my friend's going through here. I don't know what his specific needs are, but I just pray you would move into this situation and help him. So I went up into my house, didn't think anything twice of it. And then he texts me later that night. He's like, you know, when you prayed, I had talked a lot with him about God. He's like, I don't know what it is, but I just sense God's presence there. And then about 5 days later, he decided to become a Christian. And I'm just saying that along with the arguments and along with the clear explanations And along with all the other things that we talk to non-Christian friends about, we ought to have this confident awareness that God is powerfully involved, and we ought to be appealing to God to make himself known in a way that that particular person can understand and that will move them. And so, yeah, this is something we can't lose, this idea that miracles are real, that God is present, and that he wants to be part of our witnessing when we're out there talking to people. All right, Father, I just pray that as we walk out into the world and talk to people, I pray that you would really help us to have this bold confidence that you're involved, that we wouldn't just see this as a horizontal transaction. And I also pray you'd protect us from being credulous and ridiculous about miracle claims. Help us remember this is not quite the New Testament birth of the new covenant or the appearance of the Messiah here. We're in a different time. But we do affirm that you're able to do miracles, and they do still happen. Just help us have a balanced view of this area, God. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.